Research by Dr. Susan Leahy of the University of Limerick exploring practical perspectives on Irish rape trials was delivered at a keynote webinar hosted and commissioned by the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre yesterday to discuss the report and many of its recommendations and indeed the realities of rape trials in Ireland. I'm joined on the line now by Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ciara.
One of the things that struck me about Dr. Susan Leahy's recommendations is the sheer number of them and that they touch virtually every aspect of the realities of being involved as a complainant in a rape trial in Ireland.
Yeah, you're right. There are a number of recommendations and she hasn't touched on everything. She's only kind of honed in on half a dozen areas of greatest need. And so that's why Dr. Leahy would also say that this needs to be read in conjunction with other recommendations that came up last year from Tom O'Malley of the University NUI Galway. His recommendations for changes in the system, because what's becoming clear is that whatever the criminal justice system can offer by way of protection, it was never built and it was never structured and it doesn't work for anybody, really, in terms of these intimate offences, you know, sexual offences, domestic violence. These are the kind of things that the criminal justice system used to never have to deal with because they weren't talked about, they weren't dealt with, they weren't really part of the system. And if people were talking about rape or other sexual assault, it was always kind of the stranger coming in, you know, assaulting somebody. So as it stands right now, there's an awful lot wrong with our system. And Dr. Leahy comes up with 18 recommendations, some of which reflect what was said in the O'Malley report, but some of which come from the way in which what's interesting about this research for researchers is that this is the first time that the people who were researched were asked about their perspectives on rape trials, and they were barristers who are in the court on a regular basis prosecuting and defending, and people who support those who go into court, the complainants going into court. So people like our court accompaniment staff and those who accompany people from the victim's service in court as well. So people who go to give kind of moral support and psychological support. And they had things, very definite things to say about the gaps in the system.
One of the things that struck me is that consent, its concepts, not its legal concept of consent, we have that enshrined in law, but that concept as it is felt, experienced and lived in wider society, and then its impact on sexual violence is one of the keynote findings of Dr. Leahy's research, in that we still as a society on an individual basis do not have a firm grasp on what it is.
Yeah, and we don't know whether the person next to us has the same grasp on it or what do they think about it. What we do know is that just less than 5 years ago, in a survey, an EU-wide survey, over 20% of Irish people thought there were some circumstances in which sex without consent was okay. Now, 20% of those interviewed, but over 1,000 people were interviewed. So it does mean that there is still big gaps in understanding around consent, and no two people will necessarily agree on it. So some people will say, for instance, that the victim can provoke the person who carries out the consent by the way they dress, by the way they act, by going home with somebody, and other people will recognise that going home with somebody is not the same thing as consenting to sex. So Dr. Leahy says, look, the people who are in the courtroom are people who've come in from society. The judge, the lawyers, the jury, all of these people have lives outside of the court, and they're all brought up in a certain way. So given that consent is not well understood, everybody agreed there was a need for more raising of awareness, more discussion in our society around it. But also, a couple of the recommendations are around giving judges a formula so that they could say in a neutral way, not to convict the accused or anything, but just to say in a neutral way, here are the issues in this case. You may have heard talk today about how the person is dressed. That doesn't matter. What matters is, was the sexual activity consensual? And by giving formulas, like happens in the courts in England and Wales, the judges have formulas. They can go to the manual and they can kind of produce the information, it gives them language, and that then allows the juries to understand what is and is not relevant when they're making decisions. Because our court accompaniment worker who was there yesterday said she'd been in a case that morning where the jury kept coming back out to know more about what's the legal meaning of consent. So that seemed like a very practical, sensible suggestion.
And it's a really probative point, because I think when we're discussing rape trials and the concepts of consent, most of us ring fence that to include only the complainant and the defendant, and forget that individual concepts of consent being held by the judges, their respective barristers and the jury also themselves impact on the respective trial.
Yeah, and if you can kind of level the playing field for jurors so that they hear, I would say at the start, but some of the people interviewed thought maybe at the end, but I would say at the start, if you could outline to people that while consent looks like a very simple concept, and in some ways it is, the law says that consent must be free and voluntary, but to just expand on that a little bit, then jurors would be able to say, okay, so how somebody was dressed isn't relevant to what we're being asked to decide here. We're being asked to decide, did an assault take place? And here is what is relevant to consent. And if they were given that information going in again to make a decision, I think it would not only help the jurors, but it would also help the judges and the lawyers. I mean, we are not that far away. It's less than 3 years since that notorious case in Cork, where the very experienced senior counsel referred to a girl wearing a thong as underwear as evidence, she invited the jury to think that that might be an invitation to want sex. Now, that's the kind of thing that if you had these judicial directions, is what Dr. Leahy calls them, if you had those directions whereby the judges would say, here's what's relevant and here's what's not relevant, then everybody in the court would become more educated over time, and juries wouldn't have to worry about whether in fact the victim's behaviour was too provocative. Was she coming on too much to the other person? Had she too much drink taken? Had he too much drink taken? You know, so those things are the kind of things that you could sort out by giving people more information on something which is not generally agreed. We are generally agreed in Ireland what a box in the face looks like. Mm. We are not generally agreed on what consent in sexual activity looks like. Yes, we'll get there, but we're not there yet.
Dr. Leahy also looked at issues including sexual experience and counselling records, but I want to, if I may, Nolene, move on to legal representation for complainants. That currently isn't a feature of rape trials in Ireland, is it?
Yeah, so you get it. There is the most limited possible legal representation available, and it's minuscule, and it is very badly managed, not by the Legal Aid Board, who do their very best and who provide it, but by the system, which doesn't properly allow somebody to get even the little bit of legal representation that's there. But it's very limited. And everybody in the study recognised that a person, the only person who's in the courtroom, who's at sea in these cases, is the person who brings the complaint. Everybody else has their backup with them. They have the person who's accused has their legal team, and that's only right and proper. The state has its prosecution team, and that's only right and proper. But you are sending in somebody to tell them sometimes the most traumatic thing that ever happened in their lives, certainly one of the most private things that ever happened in their lives, and they don't have often they don't even have enough basic information about what's going on. If the jury is sent out to make a legal point, they don't know, is it something they said, is it something they did? If somebody is bullying them, there's nobody there to say, apart from if the judge decides to say, but there's nobody to stand up and say, actually, the witness is being bullied at the moment. Stop it. So the reality of sexual assault trials of all kind is that the point is that so much depends on the evidence of the complainant. If the person who brings the complaint, if they can be rattled in their evidence, if they can be made to feel bad, if they can be humiliated so that they say so if they get confused, if they get addled, if they're kept in the box for 5 days, as happened somebody we know recently on a very small point, if all of that can happen, then that is the way that the accused can very likely show that the case isn't proved beyond reasonable doubt. Well, in these cases, surely justice requires that both sides get to put their case fairly. And at the moment, the victim does not get to put their case fairly. I'm not saying they should be coached, just saying they should be given a fair hearing, because it's in the interest of all of us that everyone in the court can access justice. And what happens right now is that victims are traumatised by the court system, not helped.
And speaking of access to justice, Dr. Leahy has also raised the issue of delay, and I imagine any kind of forensic report on any aspect of the Irish Court Service will raise the matter of delays, but it has particular impacts on complainants in rape trials.
It does, because again it goes back to that point that so much of the evidence is based on what happened between two people in private, and therefore, and particularly, it's based on the evidence of the person who brings the complaint. So all of the time, between the time the incident or incidents happened and the time the case comes to court, the person who suffered the harm that this rape or other sexual assault did has to remember every single aspect of the harm in great detail. I mean, Kira, if you were injured in a road traffic accident or something and broke your arm, it's like kind of saying, do not fix your arm until the court case comes up, or even a physical assault. Do not deal with the harm or the hurt until such time as the case is over. And that shouldn't be the case. So the victim of the crime and the harm, on the one hand, needs to heal, should be getting on with their healing, and they cannot do it while they're waiting for the case to come up. And then the other side of delay is what really outraged everybody. And indeed, one of the lawyers in the report says if people understood the level of delay, they would call it a national outrage. Because you can go into court, and this is what is particularly frustrating. You get your day for the court case. You may have been waiting for 2 years. Now it might be 3 years for a rape with the backlog that's there post-COVID. And you go in and somebody makes an application to introduce extra evidence to deal with disclosure of some sort on the day of the hearing. And the court says, yeah, we have to give time for that. And that could put back the case for 6 months or a year. This is when victims have come in to say things that normally they wouldn't say to their best friend or to their parent or to their sibling. They're all tensed up, and normally they're dealing with somebody they know, and maybe even someone in their family is the person who's the accused. And this delay is one of the biggest barriers to everybody accessing justice. It's not good for the accused either, because the accused is equally in the position that they have to remember what is every single aspect of the case until the case is over. But it is just not, it's not the same as having your handbag stolen or your car stolen. These are things that you can get on with your life in the meantime. In terms of sexual offences, you cannot get on with your life. And the holding of people is cruel and it's wrong. And although Dr. Leahy didn't set out to ask about delay, she asked at the end, was there anything else that people wanted to mention? And every single person involved in the research, the lawyers and the court accompaniment workers, all came up with delay as the single biggest impediment to a fair hearing that's happening in our courts right now.
Well, Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you're affected by any of the issues raised in that interview, you can contact Dublin Rape Crisis Centre's national 24-hour helpline on 1-800-77-8888. That's 1-800-77-8888. Now, Pat Costello has taken out our lovely OB unit and he is out and about in the highways and byways of County Kildare. Are you in Naas or Salins, Pat?
I am in Salins at the moment, outside the Super Value in Waterways in Salins, on a lovely park bench, I suppose you might say it. And opposite me is Laura Marr, the manager here. We haven't spoken to Laura for a long time. Laura, are you all right without us?
Oh, Pat, we got through this pandemic with the support of all our terrific employees and the customers in the area. So we're doing really, really well here in Salins.
Normally we'd have a few outside broadcasts at this stage, but how have things been going for you? You managed to stay open all the time?
We did indeed, Pat. And in actual fact, what we did was we extended the store during the pandemic. So we've a bigger, brighter area store here in Salins. Obviously, as you said, we're sitting out now in our garden centre on a gorgeous sunny day. And another venture that we've ventured into is now that we've opened a florist store and a gift store too.
We're talking about people relaxing. There's Mick Curley over there and he's relaxing like he owns the place. Maybe he does. What's coming up from the waterways? What's coming up from Super Value?
We're very busy at the moment, Pat, with catering. As you know, that we have a catering company, Waterways Catering. So we find now that people are celebrating occasions at home rather than going out, and we take care of all their catering needs. We provide marquees, tables, chairs, the chef, the waitress, anything you can think of, as well as the exceptional food. We supply it all.
You know my address? Yeah, I'm told also you're talking about opening a big florist as well and a gift shop.
Yep, in the main entrance, Pat, we're having it decorated at the moment, but we have a florist here now in the store, so we can deliver flowers countrywide. We will take care of wreaths, any of special occasion flowers that you need, we'll take care of it with our gift store as well.
What are you looking forward to for the rest of the year, Laura?
I think a holiday, Pat.
No such thing. That's, of course, Laura Marr, who is the manager here at Super Value in the Waterway. So we're going to be around Naas, we're going to be around Salins. Ah, you never know where you might find us, but if you do, give us a wave or give us a 99. What about a 99, Ciara?
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
There were almost 30,000 contacts made to Women's Aid last year, and the organisation says in all probability this is just the tip of the iceberg and probably puts into focus the terror in which many households lived during lockdown. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Sarah Benson, Chief Executive of Women's Aid. Sarah, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara. Good afternoon to your listeners.
Now, 43% by any yardstick is a massive increase, but every year, regardless of whether there is a pandemic or not, you have thousands of people making contact with you in situations of grave distress or grave physical jeopardy.
That's right. Women's Aid run the 24-hour national free phone helpline for domestic violence, and we run a range of Dublin-based face-to-face services. And so year on year, we are seeing continuous increases in the contacts to our services by women or on behalf of women seeking assistance and support where they are subjected to or at acute risk of domestic abuse. What I'd also say is that the nearly 30,000 disclosures that our services received this year truly are the tip of the iceberg. Mm. The National Helpline also acts as a referral point to all of the local services around the country, and our numbers are just our own, they're not theirs. So, for example, in Kildare, you would have Chock Charman and all of the other services, they have their own figures as well. And even then, that will be the tip of the iceberg, because we know that the majority of those 1 in 4 women in this country who will be subjected to some form of abuse by a current or former partner during their life will not reach out to specialist support services. Indeed, we know from surveys that we've conducted over the last 2 years that about a third will probably never tell anybody at all. And what we want to highlight is the need for us to continue at a community level, at a policy level, at a service level, to encourage anyone who feels that they are in an abusive situation to reach out for support without shame, without stigma. It is a tactic of domestic violence to blame the victim, to make them internalise what's happening to them as their fault, and we have to be the voice that says no, the fault is with the abusing party, and that there is help and support out there.
Some of the reports that women have made to you, Sarah, are harrowing.
Yeah, we talk about, people often think of domestic violence as being particularly focused on physical abuse, and indeed we heard some absolutely appalling reports of very, very serious assaults and also sexual assaults, you know, women reporting broken bones, broken teeth. But at the same time, it's always really important to emphasise that actually what many, many women will report as actually being the form of abuse that has the longest term negative impact is that psychological, that coercive controlling behaviour, the behaviour that gets into your head so that an abuser is actually able to control a woman from inside her own head. So hard have they worked to try and isolate her, belittle her, get her to start changing her behaviour to meet their demands. And that is sometimes with the threat of physical violence, or there may have been perhaps one instance of physical violence, but every time after that, the threat is sufficient, and she is working constantly to avoid more physical violence by capitulating to the intense pressure to change and adapt her behaviour to meet his demands. And so that is coercive control. It is it shrinks people's worlds, it holds them, it makes it almost feel impossible to leave, and it isolates them. And at the same time, it also, as kind of an act of master manipulation, makes them feel that it's their fault that this is happening to them.
There's also forms of abuse about which we don't speak publicly that much, and that is things like financial abuse, whereas the partner will withhold access to funds to such a degree that the woman may have no money with which to feed herself or her children.
Absolutely, and we've started, actually, we have had always used the term financial abuse, but we've started to use the more expansive term of economic abuse now, because it actually can go beyond kind of withholding or holding money. It can be about controlling all of the resources in the household, everything from food to electricity, how much petrol goes in the car, because that can be used as a mechanism to control that perhaps she can go as far as the supermarket but no further. You know, checking receipts, they can be used then to also behave in degrading or treat women in deeply degrading ways, like asking them to ask for money for everything from sanitary products to, you know, the most basic needs for their children, sometimes in exchange for other things, you know, like kind of sexual access. So it can be a powerful tool to not just demean and control, but also if you then don't have money and you don't have means to economically support yourself, it becomes a huge barrier to actually leaving a dangerous and abusive relationship.
In many of the households from which women made contact with you, Sarah, there are children, and just shy of 6,000 disclosures of child abuse in the context of domestic violence made to you last year.
Indeed, we, you know, many of the women we've supported are mothers, and 24% of the women who we supported last year were experiencing abuse by an ex-partner, but where they had children in common, the abuse was absolutely not ending. And indeed, you know, that being bound by having children together has, you know, in many ways keeps not just women but the children themselves in that abusive control dynamic. We talk about in our report how the courts are used and abused by domestic violence perpetrators, and where unfortunately the courts are deaf or blind to the issues of coercive controlling tactics in things like custody and access hearings, because it must be remembered that TUSLA themselves, and indeed international research, reconfirms that witnessing abuse of a parent, in and of itself is a form of emotional abuse to children. And Barnardo's and others have been doing excellent work to really highlight and centralise the fact that children are deeply impacted by abuse being present in the home. And then also, of course, sadly, we have had many, many disclosures of abuse being very directly targeted at the children themselves.
I know, Sarah, that Women's Aid has described the pandemic as making the crisis level of domestic violence in Ireland more visible. What it has also done is underscore the lack of resources accorded on a state level to supporting anybody subjected to domestic violence of any kind.
Well, I think one of the things that has come out of the COVID-19 crisis is that before going into it, the entire sector responding to domestic violence and the infrastructure of the family law courts and, you know, the housing strategy, all of these were not adequate to meet the needs of a whole community, a whole wraparound response to not just protect and support victims of domestic violence, but also to prevent domestic violence and create a more zero tolerance society. What we are optimistic about, however, is the fact that as the government were formed in the teeth of the COVID-19 crisis, domestic and sexual violence were both named as political priorities. There is a lot of work that has been commenced by the Department of Justice under Minister Helen McEntee, and then with support of Minister Roderick O'Gorman, in terms of trying to do better at a systems level and at a resources level to look at a whole estate response to both domestic and sexual violence. So that means, you know, increased accommodation provision, but also the improvements that are envisaged with the family law system through the Family Courts Bill, the Family Justice Oversight Group, and then, you know, the services themselves need to be resourced and made accessible, because we also have the intersectional issues of, you may have migrant women, undocumented women, disabled women and children, all of whom may feel excluded or simply not be aware of the rights and services that should be available to them.
Sarah Benson, Chief Executive of Women's Aid, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you need to make contact with Women's Aid, you can do so on 1800 341 900. You can contact Jack Chairman here in County Kildare on 045 527 5844. And you can make contact with Men's Aid on 01 55 43 81 1. Inflation in certain sectors may be on the way up, but we're also more confident as consumers than we have been in the last 2 years. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Chief Economist at KBC, Austin Hughes. Austin, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon. Delighted to be on.
We're delighted to have you. I don't know that any of us love rising prices, but in some ways it makes logical sense. With certain goods and services, they have additional costs in reopening, and you'd expect an extra euro or two onto your haircut or whatever the case may be. But are prices rising across the economy?
Prices are generally rising across the economy, but in some areas a great deal more than others. And as you say, some aspects are to do very significantly with the opening up. So the example you gave, the cost of haircuts or hairdressing generally is about 9% higher than a year ago. And other areas would reflect things like the rise in international oil prices. So the cost of heat and light is up about 14% in terms of our fuel bills.
That's a huge jump.
You're seeing really significant elements. And, you know, these are things, obviously, when you're putting petrol in the car or whatever, or when you see the monthly bill for electricity, you know, then people begin to think, my God, the cost of living is running away. And the reality is that some items are still falling in prices. So at the margin, food prices are down, clothing prices are down. And then specific issues that tend to hold down the general price level would be things like the price of electrical equipment. So laptops are about 10% cheaper than they were a year ago. But of course, we don't tend to buy a new laptop every month.
I was just going to say, I'm not going to whatever the local electrical goods store is every week to buy a new laptop, but I will be going to the filling station.
Exactly. You know, so that is the sort of issue. So, you know, now the reality is over time people do spend a lot on IT, but of course the issue is the more visible costs, particularly, as I say, if you're filling the car and you kind of go, God, you know, that was, we'll say 40 quid or 40 euro last fortnight ago, now it's 50 euro, you know, or so. It's those sort of things make people very concerned about inflation, and you know, there would be broad areas around there. The price of new cars are up about 4.5%, or if you're going very green, the price of bikes are actually 5% higher than a year ago. You know, there's lots of little ways in which lots of issues are rising, and you know, consumers then are concerned. And of course, we haven't mentioned the major one, which is the cost of housing and the rise in house prices that we're seeing over the last while. So there is a strong sense that inflation is going up. In most areas, it probably is due to what the U.S. Central Bank has either called bottlenecks or base effects, that things were very much lower last year. So most of those elements hopefully will be temporary spikes in inflation. But there are other areas in which inflation is definitely a cause for concern. And that would be areas like housing costs. I should say also there were data also released today that show Ireland against other European countries. And on that basis, we're the second most expensive country in the EU. Denmark has the privilege of being the most expensive. But when you talk about things like alcoholic drink and tobacco prices, or things like heat and lights and rents, we have the privilege, as I say, and I use that word sarcastically, of being the most expensive country in Europe. So,
Austin, despite all of that, and that's an awful lot to be pessimistic about, consumer confidence, according to the latest sentiment survey by KBC Bank, shows that consumer confidence in the economy is at a 2.5-year high.
Yeah, well, the cost of living is an issue, but the reality is, we have gotten used to that in Ireland to a significant extent over the last, 20 or 30 years, that we know kind of we have bad weather and high prices, and that's just things that we take for granted. And in that regard, the very important element in terms of consumer confidence is that people are beginning to see the enormous cloud that was the pandemic just gradually beginning to ease. It's not a case that we've clear blue economic skies by any means, but the worst worries in terms of the pandemic are probably starting to fade with the opening up of the economy, with people going back to work again. It's not everyone as yet, so there are still elements in which, you know, you would say the mood is getting less nervous, but it's still cautious. Now, economists tend to talk about, you know, what will happen when the pandemic eases, and the chief economist in the Bank of England spoke about the UK consumer being like a coiled spring, that they were going to rush out and spend left, right and centre. What our sentiment measure is suggesting is that Irish consumers are definitely feeling a bit better, and there will be a pickup in spending, but there's no sense that the good times are back and everything in the garden is rosy. So I think it's reasonable that consumers feel a little bit less nervous that the pandemic is over, and also encouraging that they're not being stupid in terms of saying we don't have a problem in the world.
Well, Austin Hughes, Chief Economist at KBC, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up,
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Pat Costello has popped into Joe Mallon Motors, where I think he's going to be talking to Phil Mallon.
Yes, Philip Mallon will be talking to me in a moment. I'm just seeing, Ciara, if I could find an open top outside broadcast unit. Philip, any chance we could have an open top? You might take the top of that one there, because it's pretty warm in it. I am indeed here at Joe Mallon Motors, Nace, and I am talking to Philip Mallon. Normally it's Anthony, but Anthony's sunning himself in the Port Leash branch today. How are things in Joe Mallon Motors, Philip?
They're going very well, thank God. We're delighted to be back open to the public and been able to welcome people back into the showroom again.
What was it like during lockdown, shutdown, I was going to say?
Listen, it was, we all did what we had to do in terms of, it was click and collect or deal and deliver, whichever way it was that we were open to do, and we were able to offer that service to our customers, and it went well. Obviously, we're delighted to be able to have the Fulda team back in and to be completely reopened and welcome people back into the showroom again.
And are people coming back in?
Yes, they are. We're very happy to see them all coming back in for new and used, the new Renault range and the new Dacia range. And then we have a large selection of over 100 units in used cars as well. So it's been great to see people come back in and view the stock we have.
How do you and your staff keep up to date with all the changes? Everything's electronic now, really.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. A lot of it's done online. We were lucky to have a new website last September 2019, which launched us, which customers could buy online from our website, and that worked out well for us going into the different lockdowns and whatever. So we were able to switch quite easily from lockdown to reopening to lockdown to reopening. So it was good.
Now, Joe Mallon Motors is forever associated with the Kildare Senior Club Championship. I think the draws are happening very soon, about 2 weeks' time or so, Philip.
Yeah, happening in 2 weeks' time. So, like that, we're looking forward to having that live in the showroom on the night. And it feels like a little bit of normality coming back.
It's nice to have sport back.
Oh, big time. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for talking to us. It's wonderful to be back here at Joe Mallon Motors, where we normally conduct the draws for the Kildare Senior Football and indeed Intermediate and indeed Junior Championships, but the Joe Mallon Motors are the sponsors of the Senior Championship. So we'll be out and about. Thank you very much indeed, Philip. We'll be talking to you again. We'll be out and about again. We're heading in a bit towards Naas, and we'll be back around the Salons Road. Ah. The glory days of summer are here in Kildare.
Now, the government has announced that it is to review Ireland's equality legislation, which is, I think, 20 years old this year. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Eilish Barry. She's chief executive of FLAC. Eilish, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Ciara. It's great to be back.
We're delighted to have you. I suppose it's very timely to review periodically any piece of legislation, dependent, of course, upon the area of life to which it pertains. But, and I know that FLAC have welcomed this review. Are there areas that you feel that the Minister should focus on in particular?
Well, there are a number of areas. The legislation, as you say, is 20 years old. We know that it's at the time it was introduced, Ireland was at the forefront of anti-discrimination legislation across Europe, but to a certain extent it has fallen off the radar. We know from the annual reports of the Workplace Relations Commission that the number of people bringing claims under it has decreased. Now, that may be partly due to the fact that there's no legal aid available for claims, or people don't know about it. But there are also a number of problems with it in itself. First of all, we very much welcome the Minister's announcement, and we think it's a really timely response, an appropriate response to the COVID pandemic, which has highlighted severe inequalities in our society. We've seen the alarming rise in instances of domestic and gender-based violence, and how women and lone parents have borne the brunt of the pandemic to a disproportionately negative extent, and the acute vulnerabilities of old people and people with disabilities in care settings and in direct provision, and certain migrant workers in certain settings. But there are a few, I suppose, gaps in the legislation. The state is under an obligation, and all of its public bodies are under an obligation to promote equality of opportunity when they're carrying out all of their functions. And we would have argued all throughout the pandemic, which I suppose exacerbated or showed how much inequality there is, that equality should have been at the very forefront of the state's response to the pandemic. And we're arguing now that it needs to be, and perhaps that duty which is set out in the equality legislation needs to be taken and strengthened, and enforcement procedures need to be stronger. So that's one area of the state's responsibility. Another area where the state can be absent from the equality legislation is the state, when it's carrying out its functions, may not be subject to the prohibition on discrimination. So most people would be surprised to hear that An Garda Síochána, for instance, or the prison services, don't come within the prohibition of discrimination and harassment.
When
they're carrying out the functions, because the way the legislation has been interpreted is that the scope of the legislation applies to the provision of goods and services, and that the Gardaí, when they're stopping and arresting you or searching your home or...
are not providing you with the service.
Yeah, which is very unlike the situation in the UK and in Northern Ireland, where on Garda Síochána the police services are squarely brought within the equal status legislation.
That's a really interesting, I suppose, loophole or lacuna, because surely if the Gardaí were searching my home, Eilish, under a warrant or whatever, they're clearly not providing a service to me, and arguably I wouldn't be that happy to see them. But they are providing a service to the rest of society.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they definitely are. And, I mean, we also believe, in fact, that the failure to bring on Garda Síochána explicitly within the remit of the Equal Status Act doesn't comply with our international obligations and our obligations under the Race Directive. There's also another exemption in Section 14, which exempts anything that's required by another piece of legislation. And there's been a very recent worrying High Court judgment in relation to access to driving licenses by asylum seekers. And the High Court judge essentially found that the state was exempt from the provision because it was carrying out state policy. So it's kind of slightly ironic that there's a bigger obligation on the private sector, your local shop, your local pub, under the equality legislation than seems to apply to the state in certain respects. And we're very anxious that that would be remedied. We don't see that there's a valid reason for the state, when it's carrying out its functions, whether it's providing goods or services or just carrying out its daily activities such as planning, would in any way be exempted from the legislation. So that's one big gap in the legislation that we hope will be addressed. And we very much welcome the announcement of the review. It's something FLAC have been looking for some time. And on the basis of what the Minister said at our seminar at lunchtime, it seems to be quite a comprehensive review. The other area where we'd like to see some development is in the area of the grounds. Now, we have 9, or I suppose you could call them 10, discriminatory grounds, but I suppose one of the big gaps is there is no socio-economic disadvantage ground. So the grounds tend to be more related, but they're not exclusively related to the status. But obviously there's huge inequality as a result of socio-economic disadvantage, and that hasn't been included in the legislation to date. It is in the programme for government, and I think it's clear from what the Minister was saying at the conference at lunchtime that it is going to be part and parcel of this review, so that people wouldn't be discriminated against because of their poverty, their source of income. Now, we already have a housing assistance grant where landlords can't discriminate against people because they're in receipt of social welfare, but that only applies to the provision of housing. So a more general socioeconomic disadvantage grant would be important, where if you apply for employment and you feel you've been discriminated against because of where you live or where you come from or the fact that you may be in receipt of social welfare, that's something that could be challenged.
Well, Eilish Barry, Chief Executive of FLAC, thank you indeed for joining us.